couldn't stop thinking about her. Lifting his face into the spray, he wondered what on earth had gotten into him. At 1:15, Luke was sitting in a rocker on the front porch of his home when he heard the sound of a car slowly pulling up the long dirt drive, dust rising into the treetops. Dog was at his feet, next to the cowboy boots Luke had found in his mom's closet. Dog sat up, his ears cocked before glancing at Luke.
"Go get him,"
he urged, and Dog immediately trotted off. Luke grabbed the boots and stepped off the porch onto the grass. He waved his hat as he approached the main drive, hoping she'd spot him through the shrubbery that lined the drive. Heading straight would lead her to the main farmhouse. To get to his place, she'd need to turn off through an opening in the trees and follow a worn, grassy track. It was hard to spot unless you knew where it was, and it would have benefited from some gravel surfacing, but that was yet another item on the to-do list he'd never quite gotten around to. At the time, he hadn't thought it all that important, but now, with Sophia approaching and his heart beating faster than usual, he wished he had. Thankfully, Dog knew what to do. He'd run ahead and was standing in the main drive like a sentry until Sophia brought the car to a stop. Then he barked authoritatively before trotting back toward Luke. Luke waved his hat again, eventually catching Sophia's attention, and she turned the car. A moment later, she pulled to a stop beneath a towering magnolia tree. She stepped out, wearing tight, faded jeans that were torn at the knees, looking as fresh as summer itself. With almost cat-like eyes and faintly Slavic bone structure, she was even more striking in sunlight than she'd been the night before, and all he could do was stare at her. He had the strange feeling that in the future, whenever he thought about her, this would be the image he recalled. She was too beautiful, too refined and exotic for this country setting, but when she broke into that wide, friendly smile, he felt something clear inside, like the sun breaking through the mist. "Sorry I'm late," she called out as she closed the door, sounding nowhere near as nervous as he felt.
"It's all right,"
he said, replacing his hat and shoving his hands in his pockets. "I made a wrong turn and had to backtrack a bit, but I had a chance to drive around King." He shuffled his feet.
"And?"
"You were right. It's not all that fancy, but the people are nice. An old guy on a bench got me headed in the right direction," she said. "How are you?"
"I'm good,"
he said, finally looking up. If she could tell how unnerved he was, she gave no sign. "Did you finish all you needed to get done?"
"I checked the cattle, split some firewood, picked up a few things at the store."
"Sounds exciting," she said. Shading her eyes, she turned slowly in a circle, surveying her surroundings. By then, Dog had trotted up and introduced himself, twining around her legs.
"I take it this is Dog."
"The one and only."
She squatted down, scratching behind his ears. His tail thumped in appreciation.
"You have a terrible name, Dog," she whispered, lavishing attention on him.
His tail only thumped harder.
"It's beautiful here. Is it all yours?"
"My mom's, but yes, it's all part of the ranch."
"How big is it?"
"A little more than 800 acres, he said.
She frowned.
"That means nothing to me, you know. I'm from New Jersey. City girl, remember?"
He liked the way she said it.
"How about this?" he offered. "It starts at the road where you turned in and goes 1.5 miles in that direction, ending at the river. The land is shaped kind of like a fan, narrower at the road and getting wider toward the river, where it's more than 2 miles wide."
"That helps," she said.
"Does it?"
"Not really. How many city blocks is that?"
Her question caught him off guard and she laughed at his expression.
"I have no idea."
"I'm kidding," she said, rising.
"But this is impressive. I've never been on a ranch before."
She motioned toward the house behind her.
"And this is your house?"
He turned, following her gaze.
"I built it 2 years ago.
"And when you say you built it..."
"I did most of it, except for the plumbing and the electrical. I don't have a license for those things. But the layout and the framing, that was all me."
"Of course it was you," she said. "And I'll bet that if my car breaks down, you'll know how to fix that, too."
He squinted toward her car.
"Probably."
"You're like... old-fashioned.
A real man's man.
A lot of guys don't know how to do that stuff anymore." He couldn't tell whether she was impressed or teasing him, but he realized that he liked the way she kept him slightly off balance. Somehow it made her seem older than most of the girls he knew.
"I'm glad you're here," he said.
For a moment, it seemed as if she weren't quite sure what to make of his comment.
"I'm glad I'm here, too. Thanks for inviting me."
He cleared his throat, thinking about that.
"I had an idea that maybe I'd show you around the place."
"On horseback?"
"There's a nice spot down by the river,"
he said, not answering her question directly. "Is it romantic?" Luke wasn't quite sure how to answer that either.
"I like it, I guess,"
he said in a faltering voice.
"Good enough for me,"
she said, laughing. She pointed toward the boots he was holding.
"Am I supposed to wear those?"
"They're my mom's. I don't know if they'll fit, but they'll help with the stirrups. I put some socks in there. They're mine, and they're probably too big, but they're clean."
"I trust you," she said. "If you can fix cars and build houses, I'm sure you know how to run a washer and dryer.
Can I try them on?"
He handed them to her, and tried not to marvel at the fit of her jeans as she walked to the porch. Dog trailed behind her, his tail wagging and tongue hanging out, as if he'd discovered his new best friend. As soon as she sat, Dog began to nuzzle at her hand again, and he took that as a good sign. Dog wasn't normally so friendly. From the shade, he watched as Sophia slipped off her flats. She moved with a fluid grace, pulling on the socks and sliding her feet comfortably into the boots. She stood and took a few tentative steps.
"I've never worn cowboy boots before," she said, staring at her feet. "How do they look?"
"You look like you're wearing boots."
She gave an easy, rolling laugh, then began pacing the porch, staring again at the boots on her feet.
"I guess I do," she said,
and turned to face him. "Do I look like a cowgirl?"
"You'd need a hat for that."
"Let me try yours on," she said, holding out her hand. Luke walked toward her and removed his hat, feeling less in control than he'd felt on the bulls last night. He handed it to her and she slipped it on, tilting it back on her head.
"How's this?"
"Perfect," he thought, as perfect as any girl he'd ever seen. He smiled through the sudden dryness in his throat, thinking, "I'm in serious trouble."
"Now you look like a cowgirl."
She grinned, obviously pleased by that.
"I think I'll keep this today, if it's okay with you."
"I've got plenty,"
he said, barely hearing himself. He shuffled his boots again, trying to stay centered.
"How was it last night?"
he asked.
"I've been wondering if you had any more trouble."
She stepped down from the porch. "It was fine. Marcia was right where I'd left her."
"Did Brian bother you?"
"No," she answered. "I think he was worried you might still be around. Besides, we didn't stay long. Only another half hour or so. I was tired." By then, she'd drawn close to him. "I like the boots and hat. They're comfortable. I should probably thank your mom. Is she here?"
"No, she's at the main house. I can tell her later, though."
"What? You don't want me to meet her?"
"It's not that. She's kinda angry with me this morning."
"Why?"
"It's a long story."
Sophia tilted her head up at him. "You said the same thing last night when I asked you why you rode bulls," she remarked.
"I think you say, it's a long story, when what you really mean is, I don't want to talk about it. Am I right?"
"I don't want to talk about it."
She laughed, her face flushing with pleasure.
"So what's next?"
"I guess we can head to the barn,"
he said.
"You said you wanted to see it."
She lifted an eyebrow.
"You know I really didn't come here to see the barn, right?"
7. Sophia.
"Okay," she thought to herself as soon as the words left her mouth. "Maybe that was a little too forward." She blamed it on Marcia. If only Marcia hadn't pestered her with questions last night and all morning about what had happened the night before and the fact that she was going to the ranch today. If only she hadn't vetoed the first two outfits that Sophia had selected, all the while repeating, "I can't believe you're going riding with that hottie." Then Sophia wouldn't have been so nervous. Eye candy, hot, hottie. Marcia insisted on using those words instead of his name. As in, "So, Mr. Eye Candy swooped in and saved you, huh?" Or, "What did you and the hottie talk about?"
or simply,
"He's so hot!"
It was no wonder she'd missed the turn after getting off the highway. By the time she'd pulled in the drive, she could feel a tiny bead of sweat trickling down her ribcage. She wasn't necessarily anxious, but she was definitely on edge. And whenever that happened, she talked a lot and found herself taking cues from people like Marcia and Mary Kate. But then sometimes her old self would come barreling through, and she'd blurt out things better left unsaid. Like today. And last night when she said she'd like to go horseback riding. And Luke hadn't helped matters. He'd walked up to her car in that soft chambray work shirt and jeans, his brown curls trying to escape his hat. He'd barely raised those long-lashed blue eyes, surprising her with his shyness, when she felt her stomach do a little flip. She liked him. Really liked him. But more than that, for whatever reason, she trusted him. She had the impression that his world was ordered by a sense of right and wrong, that he had integrity. He wasn't preoccupied with pretending to be something he wasn't, and his face was an open book. When she surprised him, she could see it instantly. When she teased him, he laughed easily at himself. By the time he finally mentioned the barn, well, she just couldn't help herself. Although she thought she detected something that resembled a blush, he just ducked his head and popped inside to grab another hat. When he returned, they set off side by side, falling into an easy rhythm. Dog ran ahead and then came rushing back to them before darting off in yet another direction, a moving bundle of energy. Little by little, she felt her anxiety dissipate. They skirted the grove of trees that surrounded his house, angling toward the main drive. As the vista opened before her, she took in the main house, with its big covered porch and black shutters, backed by a copse of towering trees. Beyond it stood the aging barn and lush pastures nestled among green, rolling hills. In the distance, the banks of a small lake were dotted with cattle, smoky, blue-tipped mountains near the horizon framing the landscape like a postcard. On the opposite side of the drive stood a grove of Christmas trees planted in neat, straight rows. A breeze moved through the grove, making a soft fluting sound that resembled music. "I can't believe you grew up here," she breathed, taking it all in. She motioned toward the house. "Is that where your mom lives?"
"I was actually born in that farmhouse."
"What? No horses fast enough to get to the hospital?" He laughed, seemingly more relaxed since they'd left his house.
"A lady on the next ranch over used to be a midwife. She's a good friend of my mom's, and it was a way to save some money. She's like that, my mom, I mean. She's kind of a hawk when it comes to expenses."
"Even for childbirth?"
"I'm not sure she was fazed by childbirth. Living on a farm, she'd been around a lot of births. Besides, she was born in the house too, so she was probably thinking, what's the big deal?"
Sophia felt the gravel crunching beneath her boots. "How long has your family owned the ranch?" she asked.
"A long time. My great-grandfather bought most of it in the 1920s, and then, when the Depression hit, he was able to add to it. He was a pretty good businessman. From there, it became my grandfather's and then my mom's. She took over when she was 22.
As he answered, she looked around, amazed at how remote it felt despite its proximity to the highway. They passed the farmhouse, and on the far side there were smaller, weather-beaten wooden structures surrounded by fencing. When the wind shifted, Sophia caught the scent of conifer and oak. Everything about the ranch was a refreshing change from the campus where she spent most of her time. Just like Luke, she thought, but she tried not to dwell on the observation. "What are those buildings?" she asked, pointing.
"The closest one is the hen house where we keep the chickens, and behind that is where we keep the hogs. Not many, only three or four at a time. Like I mentioned last night, we mainly do cattle here."
"How many do you have?"
"More than 200 pair," he said. "We also have 9 bulls."
She furrowed her brow. "Pair?"
"A mature cow and her calf."
"Then why don't you just say you have 400?
"That's just the way they're counted, I guess. So you know the size of the herd you can offer for sale that year. We don't sell the calves. Others do, that's veal, but we're known for our grass-fed organic beef. Our customers are mainly high-end restaurants."
They followed the fence line, approaching an ancient live oak
with massed limbs that spread in all directions like a spider. As they passed beneath the canopy of its limbs, they were greeted with a shrill assortment of bird cries, sounding their warnings. Sophia lifted her gaze to the barn as they neared it, realizing that Luke hadn't been kidding. It looked abandoned, the entire structure listing slightly and held together by rotting boards. Ivy and Kudzu crawled up the sides, and a section of the roof appeared entirely stripped of shingles. He nodded toward it.
What do you think?
I'm wondering if you ever think of raising it, just to show mercy?
It's sturdier than it looks. We just keep it this way for effect.
Maybe, she said with a skeptical expression. Either that, or you've never gotten around to fixing it.
What are you talking about? You should have seen it before the repairs.
She smiled. He thought he was so funny.
Is that where you keep the horses?
Are you kidding? I wouldn't put them in that death trap.
This time, she laughed despite herself.
What do you use the barn for, then?
Storage, mostly. The mechanical bull is in there, too, and that's where I practice. But other than that, it's mainly filled with broken stuff. A couple of broken-down trucks, a tractor from the 50s, used well pumps, broken heat pumps, stripped engines. Most of it is junk, but like I said, my mom is funny about expenses. Sometimes I can find a part that I need to fix whatever needs fixing.
Does that happen a lot? That you find something?
Not too much. But I can't order a part until after I check. It's one of my mom's rules.
Beyond the barn stood a small stable, open on one side to a medium-sized corral. Three big-chested horses studied them as they approached. Sophia watched as Luke opened the door to the stable and produced three apples from the sack he'd been carrying.
Horse! Get over here!
He called out, and at his command a chestnut-colored horse ambled in his direction. The two darker horses followed.
Horse is mine, he explained. The others are friendly and demon.
She hung back, knitting her brows in concern. I think I should probably ride friendly, huh? She said.
I wouldn't, he said. He bites and he'll try to throw you. He's awful for anyone but my mom. Demon, on the other hand, is a sweetheart.
She shook her head. What is it with you and animal names? By the time she turned toward the pasture again, Horse had sidled up close, dwarfing her. She stepped back quickly, though Horse, focused on Luke and the apples, didn't appear to notice her.
Can I pet him?
Of course,
he said, holding out the apple.
He likes his nose rubbed, and scratch him behind the ears.
She wasn't ready to touch his nose, but she ran her fingers gently behind the ears, watching as they tilted in pleasure, even as the horse continued to chomp on the apple. Luke led Horse to a stall, and Sophia watched as he readied it for the ride. Bridle, pad, and eventually the saddle, every movement practiced and unconscious. As he worked, his jeans pulling tight as he bent over, Sophia felt the heat rise in her cheeks. Luke was just about the sexiest thing she'd ever seen. She quickly turned away, pretending to study the rafters as he finished up and turned to saddle Demon.
Okay,
he said, adjusting the stirrup lengths.
You ready?
Not really, she admitted. But I'll try. You're sure he's a sweetheart?
He's like a baby, Luke assured her. Just put your hand on the horn and put your left boot in the stirrup. Then just swing your leg over.
She did as he told her, climbing onto the horse even as her heart began to race. As she tried to get comfortable, it occurred to her that the horse beneath her was like a giant muscle ready to flex.
It's higher than I thought it would be.
You'll be fine,
he said, handing her the reins. Before she had time to protest, he was already on horse, obviously at ease.
Demon doesn't need much, he said. Just touch the reins against his neck and he'll turn for you like this. And to make him go, just tap his sides with your heels. To make him stop, pull back.
He demonstrated a couple of times, making sure she understood.
You do remember that this is my first time, right?
She asked.
You told me.
And just so you know, I have no desire to do anything crazy. I don't want to fall off. One of my sorority sisters broke her arm on one of these animals, and I don't want to be stuck wearing a cast while I have to write papers.
He scratched at his cheek, waiting.
Are you finished?
He asked. I'm just setting the ground rules.
He sighed, shaking his head in amusement.
City girls,
he said, and with a flick of his wrist, Horse turned and began walking away. A moment later, Luke had leaned over and lifted the gate latch, allowing it to swing open. He made his way through it, the stall blocking her line of sight.
"You're supposed to follow me,"
he called out. With her heart still beating fast and her mouth dry as sawdust, she took a deep breath. There was no reason she couldn't do this. She could ride a bike, and this wasn't all that different, right? People rode horses every day. Little kids rode horses, so how hard could it be? And even if it was hard, so what? She could do hard. English Lit with Professor Alder was hard. Working 14 hours in the deli on Saturdays when all her friends were going to the city was hard. Letting Brian run her through the ringer. Now that had been hard. Steeling herself, she fluttered the reins and tapped Demon on the sides. Nothing. She tapped again. His ear twitched, but otherwise he remained as immobile as a statue. Okay, not so easy, she thought. Demon obviously wanted to stay home. Luke and Horse wandered back into view. He lifted the brim of his hat.
Are you coming?
He asked. He doesn't want to move, she explained.
Tap him and tell him what you want him to do. Use the reins. He needs to feel that you know what you're doing.
Fat chance, she thought. I have no idea what I'm doing. She tapped again, and still nothing. Luke pointed at the horse like a schoolteacher reprimanding a child.
Quit messing around, Demon, he finally barked. You're scaring her. Get over here.
Miraculously, his words were enough to get the horse moving without Sophia doing anything at all. But because she was caught off guard, she rocked backward in the saddle, and then, trying to keep her balance, instinctively lunged forward. Demon's ear twitched again, as if he were wondering if the whole thing was some sort of practical joke. She held the reins with both hands, ready to make him turn, but Demon didn't need her. He passed through the gate, snorting at Horse as he passed, and then stopped while Luke shut the gate behind her and returned to her side. He kept Horse at a slow but steady walk, and Demon was content to walk beside him without any work at all on her part. They crossed the drive and veered onto a path that skirted the last row of Christmas trees. The scent of evergreen was stronger here, reminding her of the holidays. As she gradually grew used to the rhythm of the horse's gait, she felt small weights lifting from her body and her breathing returning to normal. The far end of the grove gave way to a thin strand of forest, maybe a football field wide. The horses picked their way through an overgrown trail, almost on autopilot, uphill and then downhill, winding deeper into an untamed world. Behind them, the ranch slowly drifted from view, gradually making her feel as if she were in a distant land. Luke was content to leave her alone with her thoughts as they made their way deeper into the trees. Dog ran ahead, nose to the ground, vanishing and reappearing as he veered this way and that. She ducked beneath a low-hanging branch and watched from the corner of her eye as Luke leaned to avoid another, the ground becoming rockier and densely carpeted. Thickets of blackberries and holly bushes sprouted in clumps, hugging the moss-covered trunks of oak trees. Squirrels darted along the branches of hickory trees, chattering a warning, while shafts of fractured sunlight cut through the foliage, lending her surroundings a dreamlike quality. "It's beautiful out here," Sophia said, her voice sounding strange to her own ears. Luke turned in his saddle.
I was hoping you'd like it.
Is this your land, too?
Some of it. We share it with a neighboring ranch. It acts as a windbreak and property border.
Do you ride out here often?
I used to. But lately, I'm only out here when one of the fences is broken. Sometimes the cattle wander out this way.
And here I was, thinking this is something you do with all the girls.
He shook his head. I've never brought a girl out here.
Why not?
I just never thought of it, I guess.
He seemed as surprised by the realization as she was. Dog trotted up, checked to make sure they were okay, then wandered off again. So tell me about this old girlfriend. Angie, was it? He shifted slightly, no doubt surprised that she remembered.
There's not really much to tell. Like I told you, it was just a high school thing.
Why did it end? He seemed to reflect on the question before answering.
I went on the tour the week after I graduated from high school, he said. Back then, I couldn't afford to fly to the events, so I was on the road an awful lot. I'd leave on Thursday and wouldn't get home until Monday or Tuesday. Some weeks I never made it home at all, and I don't blame her for wanting something different, especially since it wasn't likely to change.
She digested this. So how does it work? She asked, shifting in her saddle. If you want to be a bull rider, I mean. What do you have to do to get into it?
There's not much to it, really, he answered. You buy your card with the PBR.
PBR? She asked, cutting him off.
Professional bull riders, he said. They run the events. Basically, you sign up and pay your entry fee. When you get to the event, you draw a bull and they let you ride.
You mean anyone can do it? Like if I had a brother and he decided that he wanted to start riding tomorrow, he could?
Pretty much.
That's ridiculous. What if someone has no experience at all?
Then they'd probably get hurt.
You think?
He grinned and scratched under the brim of his hat.
It's always been like that. In rodeo, most of the prize money comes from the competitors themselves, which means that people who are good at it like it when the other riders aren't so good. It means they have a better chance to walk away from an event with cash in their pocket.
That seems kind of heartless.
How else would you do it? You can practice all you want, but there's only one way to know whether you can ride, and that's to actually try it.
Thinking back, she wondered how many of the riders last night were first-timers. Okay, someone enters an event, and let's say he's like you and he happens to win. What happens next?
He shrugged. Bull riding is a little different than traditional rodeo. Bull riders have their own tour these days, but actually it's two tours. You have the big one, which is the one on television all the time, and you have the little tour, which is kind of like the minor leagues. If you earn enough points in the minor leagues, you get promoted to the major leagues. In this sport, that's where the real money is.
And last night?
Last night was an event on the little tour.
Have you ever ridden in the big tour?
He reached down, patting horse's neck.
I rode in it for 5 years.
Were you good?
I did all right.
She evaluated his answer, remembering that he'd said the same thing last night, when he'd won. Why do I get the sense that you're a lot better than you're implying?
I don't know.
She scrutinized him.
You might as well tell me how good you were. I can always Google you, you know.
He sat up straighter.
I made the PBR World Championships 4 years in a row. To do that, you have to be in the top 35 in the standings.
So you're one of the best, in other words.
I was. Not so much anymore. I'm pretty much starting over again.
By then, they'd reached a small clearing near the river, and they brought the horses to a halt on the high bank. The river wasn't wide, but Sophia had the sense that the slow-moving water was deeper than it appeared. Dragonflies flitted over the surface, breaking the stillness, causing tiny ripples that radiated to the edge. Dog lay down, panting from his exertions, his tongue hanging out the side of his mouth. Beyond him, in the shade of a gnarled oak tree, she noticed what seemed to be the remains of an old camp, with a decaying picnic table and an abandoned fire pit.
"What is this place?" she asked, adjusting her hat.
"My dad and I used to come fishing here. There's a submerged tree under the water just over there, and it's a great place to catch bass. We used to stay out here all day. It was kind of our place, just for the two of us. My mom hates the smell of fish, so we'd catch them and clean and cook them out here before bringing them back to the farmhouse. Other times, my dad would bring me out here after practice, and we'd just stare at the stars. He never graduated from high school, but he could name every constellation in the sky. I had some of the best times of my life out here."
She stroked Demon's mane. "You miss him?"
"All the time," he said. "Coming out here helps me remember him the right way. The way he should be remembered."
She could hear the loss in his tone, sense the tightness in his posture.
"How did he die?" she asked, her voice soft.
"We were coming home from an event in Greenville, South Carolina. It was late and he was tired, and a deer suddenly tried to dart across the highway. He didn't have time to even jerk the wheel, and the deer went through the windshield. The truck ended up rolling 3 times, but even before then, it was too late. The impact broke his neck."
"You were with him?"
"I dragged him out of the wreckage," he said. "I can remember holding him and frantically trying to get him to wake up until the paramedics got there."
She paled. "I can't even imagine something like that."
"Neither could I," he said.
One minute we're talking about my rides, and the next minute, he was gone. It didn't seem real. It still doesn't. Because he wasn't just my dad. He was my coach and partner and friend, too. And he trailed off, lost in thought, then slowly shook his head. And I don't know why I'm telling you all this.
It's okay, she said, her voice soft. I'm glad you did.
He acknowledged her words with a grateful nod.
What are your parents like?
He asked. They're passionate, she finally said.
About everything. What do you mean?
You'd have to live with us to understand. They can be crazy about each other one minute and screaming at each other in the next. They have deep opinions on everything from politics to the environment to how many cookies we should have after dinner, even what language to speak that day.
Language?
He asked, breaking in. My parents wanted all of us to be multilingual, so on Mondays we spoke French, Tuesdays was Slovak, Wednesdays was Czech. It used to drive me and my sisters crazy, especially when we had friends come over because they couldn't understand anything that anyone was saying. And they were perfectionists when it came to grades. We had to study in the kitchen, and my mom would quiz us before every test. And let me tell you, if I ever brought home a score that wasn't absolutely perfect, my mom and dad acted like it was the end of the world. My mom would wring her hands, and my dad would tell me how disappointed he was, and I'd end up feeling so guilty that I'd study again for a test that I'd already taken. I know it's because they never wanted me to struggle like they did, but it could be a little oppressive at times. On top of that, all of us had to work in the deli, which meant that we were pretty much always together. Let's just say that by the time college rolled around, I was looking forward to making my own decisions. Luke lifted an eyebrow.
And you chose Brian.
Now you sound like my parents, she said. They didn't like Brian from the beginning. As nuts as they are about some things, they're actually pretty smart. I should have listened to them.
We all make mistakes, he said. How many languages do you speak?
4, she answered, pushing up the brim of her hat in the same way he did. But that includes English.
I speak 1, including English.
She smiled, liking his comment. Liking him.
I don't know how much good it will do me, unless I end up working at a museum in Europe. Do you want to do that?
Maybe. I don't know.
Right now, I'd be willing to work anywhere.
He was quiet when she finished, absorbing what she'd said to him.
Listening to you makes me wish I had been more serious about school. I wasn't a bad student, but I wasn't brilliant either. I didn't work very hard at it. But now I can't help thinking that I should have gone to college.
I think it's a lot safer than riding bulls. Though she meant it as a joke, he didn't smile.
You're absolutely right.
After leaving the clearing by the river, Luke took her on a leisurely tour of the rest of the ranch, their conversation wandering from one subject to the next, Dog always roaming in their vicinity. They rode between the Christmas trees and skirted past the beehives, and he led her through the rolling pasture land used by the cattle. They talked about everything from the kind of music they liked to their favorite movies to Sophia's impressions of North Carolina. She told him about her sisters and what it was like to grow up in a city, and also about life on the cloistered campus at Wake. Though their worlds were entirely different, she was surprised to discover that he seemed to find her world just as fascinating as she found his. Later, when she had gained a bit more confidence in the saddle, she brought Demon to a trot, and eventually to a canter. Luke rode beside her the whole time, ready to grab her if she was about to fall, telling her when she was leaning too far forward or back, and reminding her to keep the reins loose. She hated trotting, but when the horse cantered, she found it easier to adjust to the steady, rolling rhythm. They rode from one fence to the next and back again 4 or 5 times, moving a little faster with every lap. Feeling a little more sure of herself, Sophia tapped Demon and urged him to go even faster. Luke was caught unawares, and it took a few seconds for him to catch up, and as they raced beside each other, she reveled in the feel of the wind in her face, the experience terrifying and exhilarating. On the way back, she urged Demon to go even faster, and when they finally brought the horses to a halt a few minutes later, she started to laugh, the surge of adrenaline and fear spilling out of her. When the giddy waves of laughter eventually passed, they slowly made their way back to the stables. The horses were still breathing hard and sweating, and after Luke removed the saddles, she helped him brush them down. She fed Demon an apple, already feeling the first twinges of soreness in her legs, but not caring in the slightest. She'd ridden a horse, actually ridden, and in a burst of pride and satisfaction, she looped her arm through Luke's as they strolled back to the house. They walked leisurely, neither of them needing to talk. Sophia replayed the events of the day in her head, glad that she'd come. From what she could tell, Luke shared her sense of peace and contentment as well. As they neared the house, Dog darted ahead toward the water bowl on the porch. He lapped at it between pants, then collapsed onto his belly.
"He's tired," she said,
startled at the sound of her own voice.
"He'll be fine. He follows me when I ride out every morning."
He took off his hat and wiped the perspiration from his brow.
"Would you like something to drink?"
he asked.
"I don't know about you, but I could really use a beer."
"Sounds great."
"I'll be back in a minute,"
he promised, and headed into the house. As he walked away, she studied him, trying to make sense of her undeniable attraction to him. Who could make sense of any of this? She was still trying to figure it out when he emerged with a pair of ice-cold bottles. He twisted off a cap and handed her a bottle, their fingers brushing slightly. He motioned to the rockers. She took a seat and leaned back with a sigh, her hat tilting forward. She'd almost forgotten that she'd been wearing it. She took it off, setting it in her lap before taking a sip. The beer was icy and refreshing.
"You rode really well," he said.
"You mean I rode well for a beginner?
I'm not ready for the rodeo yet, but it was fun." "You have naturally good balance," he observed.
But Sophia wasn't listening. Instead, she was staring past him at the little cow that had appeared from around the corner of his house. It seemed to be taking an inordinate interest in them.
"I think one of your cows got loose," she pointed. "A little one."
He followed her gaze, his expression turning to fond recognition.
"That's Mudbath. I don't know how she does it, but she ends up here a couple of times a week. There's got to be a gap in the fencing somewhere, but I haven't found it yet."
"She likes you."
"She adores me," he said. "Last March, we had a wet, cold streak, and she got trapped in the mud. I spent hours trying to pull her out, and I had to bottle feed her for a few days. Ever since then, she's been coming around here regularly."
"That's sweet," she said, trying not to stare at him, but finding it hard to avoid. "You have an interesting life here." He took off his hat and combed his fingers through his hair before taking another sip. When he spoke, his voice lost some of the customary reserve she'd grown used to.
"Can I tell you something?"
A long moment passed before he continued.
"And I don't want you to take this the wrong way."
"What is it?"
"You make it seem a lot more interesting than it really is."
"What are you talking about?" He began to pick at the label on his bottle, peeling the paper back with his thumb, and she had the impression that he wasn't so much searching for the answer as waiting for it to come to him before he turned to face her.
"I think you're just about the most interesting girl I've ever met."
She wanted to say something, anything, but she felt as if she were drowning in those blue eyes, her words seeming to dry up. Instead, she watched as he leaned toward her, hesitating for an instant. His head tilted slightly, and the next thing she knew, she was tilting her head too, their faces growing closer. It wasn't long. It wasn't heated, but as soon as their lips came together, she knew with sudden certainty that nothing had ever felt so easy and so right. The perfect ending to an unimaginably perfect afternoon.
Eight. Ira.
Where am I? I wonder this for only a moment before I shift in the seat, pain providing me with an answer. It is a waterfall, white hot as my arm and shoulder explode. My head feels like splintered glass and my chest has begun to throb as if something heavy has just been lifted off me. Overnight, the car has become an igloo. The snow on the windshield has begun to glow, which means that sunrise has come. It is Sunday morning, February 6th, 2011, and according to the watch face that I have to squint to make out, it's 7:20 a.m. Last night, sunset occurred at 5:50 p.m., and I'd been driving in the darkness for an hour before I went off the highway. I have been here for over 12 hours, and though I am still alive, there is a moment when I feel nothing but terror. I have felt this kind of terror before. Strangers would not know this by looking at me. As I worked at the shop, customers were often surprised to learn that I had been in the war. I never mentioned it, and only once did I talk to Ruth about what happened to me. We never spoke of it again. Back then, Greensboro was not the city it would eventually become. In many ways, it was still a small town, and many of the people I'd known growing up were aware that I'd been wounded while fighting in Europe. And yet they, like me, had little desire to discuss the war after it ended. For some, the memories were simply too unbearable. For others, the future simply held more interest than the past. But if anyone had asked, I would have said that my story was not worth the time it would take to listen to it. If nonetheless pressed for details, I would have told them that I'd enlisted in the U.S. Army Air Corps in June 1942. And after being sworn in, I boarded a train filled with other cadets bound for the Army Air Corps Reception Center in Santa Ana, California. It was my first trip out west. I spent the next month learning how to follow orders, clean bathrooms, and march properly. From there, I was sent to primary flight school at Mira Loma Flight Academy in Oxnard, where I learned the basics of meteorology, navigation, aerodynamics, and mechanics. During this time, I also worked with an instructor and was gradually taught to fly. I flew my first solo there, and within 3 months I had accumulated enough hours in the air to move to the next stage of training at Gardner Field in Taft. From there, it was off to Roswell, New Mexico for even more flight training, and then back to Santa Ana, where I finally began my formal training as a navigator. Yet even when I completed the training there, I still wasn't done. I was sent to Mather Field near Sacramento, where I attended advanced navigation school, to learn how to navigate by the stars with dead reckoning, through the use of visual references on the ground. Only then did I receive my commission. It was another 2 months before I was sent to the European theater. First, the crew was sent to Texas, where we were assigned to the B-17, and then finally to England. By the time I flew my first combat mission in October 1943, I'd been training stateside for almost a year and a half, as far from action as someone in the military could possibly be. This is not what people would have wanted to hear. But this was my experience of the war. It was training and transfers and even more training. It was about weekend passes and my first visit to a California beach where I laid eyes on the Pacific for the very first time. It was having the chance to see the giant sequoias in Northern California, trees so large they seemed beyond comprehension. It was about the feeling of awe that overcame me when soaring over the desert landscape as dawn was breaking. And it was also, of course, about Joe Torre, the best friend I ever had. We had little in common. He was a Catholic from Chicago, a baseball player with a gap-toothed smile. He had trouble stringing a single sentence together without cursing, but he laughed a lot and poked fun at himself. And everyone wanted him along when weekend passes were handed out. They wanted him to join their poker games and to cruise downtown with them, since women also seemed to find him irresistible. Why he often chose to spend time with me has always been a mystery. But it was because of Joe that I ever felt included at all. It was with Joe that I drank my first beer while sitting on the Santa Monica Pier. And it was with Joe that I smoked the first and only cigarette of my life. It was Joe that I spoke with on those days I particularly missed Ruth. And Joe would listen in a way that made me want to keep talking until I finally began to feel better. Joe, too, had a fiancé back home, a pretty girl named Marla, and he admitted that he didn't particularly care what happened in the war as long as he was able to get back to her. Joe and I ended up on the same B-17. The captain was Colonel Bud Ramsey, a genuine hero and a genius as a pilot. He'd already flown one round of combat missions and had been assigned a second. He was calm and collected under the most harrowing circumstances, and we knew we were lucky to have him as our commander. My actual war experiences began on October 2nd, when we raided a submarine base in Emden. 2 days later, we were part of a squadron of 300 bombers converging on Frankfurt. On October 10th, we bombed a railway junction at Munster, and on October 14th, on a day that became known as Black Thursday, the war came to an end for me. The target was a ball-bearing plant in Schweinfurt. It had been bombed once a few months earlier, but the Germans were making good headway in repairs. Because of the distance from base, our formation bombers had no fighter support, and this time the bombing run was anticipated. German fighters showed up at the coastline, dogging various squadrons all the way, and by the time we were within striking range, flak bursts had already formed a dense fog over the entire city. German rockets exploded all around us at high altitude, the shock wave shaking the plane. We had just dropped our payload when a number of enemy fighters suddenly closed in. They came from every direction, and all around us bombers began to fall from the sky, enveloped in fire as they spiraled toward the earth. Within minutes, the formation was in tatters. Our gunner was struck in the forehead and fell back into the aircraft. On instinct, I climbed into his seat and began to fire, loosing close to 500 rounds without doing any appreciable damage to the enemy. At that moment, I did not think that I would survive, but I was too terrified to stop firing. We were strafed by enemy fire on one side and then the other. From my vantage point, I could see gigantic holes being ripped into the wing. When we lost an engine to enemy fire, the plane began to shimmy. The roar louder than anything I'd ever heard before as Bud struggled with the controls. The wing suddenly dipped, and the plane started to lose altitude, smoke billowing behind us. The fighters closed in for the kill, and more flak tore through the fuselage. We dropped 1,000 feet, then 2,000, 5,000, 8,000. Bud somehow managed to straighten the wings, and like a mythological creature, the nose of the plane somehow began to rise. Miraculously, the plane was still aloft, but we were separated from the formation, alone above enemy territory, and still the flak pursued us. Bud had turned us toward home in a desperate bid to make our escape. When flak shattered the cockpit, Joe was struck, and instinctively he turned toward me. I saw his eyes go wide in disbelief and his lips form my name. I lunged toward him, wanting to do something, anything, when suddenly I fell, my body losing all its strength. I couldn't understand what had happened. At the time, I didn't know I'd been hit, and I tried and failed again to get to my feet to help Joe when I felt a series of sharp, stinging burns. I looked down and saw large blooms of red spreading across the lower half of my body. The world seemed to telescope around me, and I passed out. I don't know how we made it back to base, other than to say that Bud Ramsey performed a miracle. Later in the hospital, I was told that people took photographs of the plane after we landed, marveling that it had been able to stay airborne. But I didn't look at the photographs, even when my strength had returned. I was told that I should have died. By the time we'd reached England, I'd lost more than half my blood and I was as pale as a swan. My pulse rate was so low that they couldn't find it in my wrist, but they nonetheless rushed me into surgery. I wasn't expected to survive the night, or the night after that. A telegram was sent to my parents explaining that I'd been wounded and that more information would be forthcoming. By more information, the Army Air Corps meant another later telegram informing them of my death. But the second telegram was never sent, because somehow I did not die. This was not the conscious choice of a hero. I was not a hero and remained unconscious. Later, I wouldn't remember a single dream, or even whether I'd had any dreams at all. But somehow, on the fifth day after surgery, I woke, my body drenched in sweat. According to the nurses, I was delirious and screaming in agony. Peritonitis had set in, and I was rushed into surgery once more. I do not remember this either, or any of the days that followed. The fever lasted for 13 days, and on each successive day, when asked about my prognosis, the doctor shook his head. Though I was unaware of it, I was visited by Bud Ramsey and surviving crew members before they were assigned to a new plane. Meanwhile, a telegram was sent to the home of Joe Torre's parents, announcing his death. The RAF bombed Kassel, and the war continued. The fever finally broke as the calendar turned to November. When I opened my eyes, I didn't know where I was. I couldn't remember what had happened, and I couldn't seem to move. I felt as though I'd been buried alive, and with all my strength I was able to whisper only a single syllable. Ruth. The sun grows brighter, and the winds have grown sharper, yet still no one comes. The terror I felt earlier has finally passed, and in its absence my mind begins to wander. I note that being buried alive in a car by snowfall is not unique to me. Not too long ago on the Weather Channel, I saw a clip about a man in Sweden who, like me, was trapped in his car while snow gradually buried him alive. This was near a town called Umeå, near the Arctic Circle, where temperatures were well below zero. However, according to the broadcaster, the car became an igloo of sorts. Even though this man would not have survived long if exposed to the elements, the temperature inside the car could be tolerated for long periods, especially since the man was dressed appropriately and had a sleeping bag with him. But this was not the amazing part. What was amazing was how long the man survived. Though the man had no food or water and ate only handfuls of snow, the doctor said his body went almost into a sort of hibernation state. His bodily processes slowed down enough for him to be rescued after 64 days. Good God, I remember thinking. 64 days! When I saw the segment, I could barely imagine such a thing. But obviously, it has taken on new meaning at the present time. 2 months in the car for me would mean that someone would find me in early April. The azaleas would be blooming, the snow long since gone, and days will already begin to feel like summer. If I'm rescued in April, it will probably be by young people wearing hiking shorts and sunscreen. Someone will find me before then, of this I'm sure. But even though it should make me feel better, it doesn't. Nor am I comforted by the fact that the temperature is nowhere near as cold or that I have 2 sandwiches in the car, because I am not the Swedish man. He was 44 and uninjured. My arm and collarbone are broken. I've lost a lot of blood. And I'm 91 years old. I'm afraid that any movement at all will cause me to pass out, and frankly, my body has been in hibernation mode for the past 10 years. If my bodily processes slow any further, I'll be permanently horizontal. If there is a silver lining in any of this, it's that I'm not hungry yet. This is common for people my age. I haven't had much of an appetite in recent years, and I struggle to consume a cup of coffee and single piece of toast in the morning. But I am thirsty. My throat feels as though it has been clawed with nails, but I don't know what to do. Though there is a bottle of water in the car, I am afraid of the torture I will feel if I try to find it. And I am cold, so cold. I have not endured this kind of shivering since my stay in the hospital a lifetime ago. After my surgeries, after the fever broke and I thought my body was beginning to heal, a fierce headache set in, and the glands in my throat began to swell. The fever came back, and I felt a throbbing soreness in the place where no man wants to feel it. At first the doctors were hopeful that the second fever was related to the first, but it wasn't. The man next to me had the same set of symptoms, and within days, three more in our ward became ill. It was mumps, a childhood disease, but in adults it's far more serious. Of all the men, I was hardest hit. I was the weakest, and the virus raged through my body for almost 3 weeks. By the time it ran its course, I weighed only 115 pounds, and I was so weak that I couldn't stand without help. It was another month before I was finally released from the hospital, but I was not cleared to fly. My weight was still too low, and I had no crew to speak of. Bud Ramsey, I learned, had been shot down over Germany, and there were no survivors. Initially, the Army Air Corps wasn't sure what to do with me, but they eventually decided to send me back to Santa Ana. I became a trainer for new recruits, working with them until the war finally came to an end. I received my discharge in January 1946, and after taking a train to Chicago to pay my respects to Joe Torre's family, I returned to North Carolina. Like veterans everywhere, I wanted to put the war behind me, but I couldn't. I was angry and bitter, and I hated what I had become. Aside from the night over Schweinfurt, I had few combat memories. Yet the war stayed with me. For the rest of my life, I carried wounds that no man could see but were impossible to leave behind. Joe Torre and Bud Ramsey were the best kind of men. Yet they had died while I had survived, and the guilt never quite left me. The flak that tore through my body made it a struggle to walk on cold winter mornings, and my stomach has never been the same. I can't drink milk or eat spicy food, and I was never able to regain all the weight I lost. I have not been in an airplane since 1945, and I found it impossible to sit through movies that dealt with war. I do not like hospitals. For me, after all, the war and my time in the hospital had changed everything.
"You are crying," Ruth says to me.
In another place at another time, I would wipe the tears from my face with the back of my hand. But here and now, the task seems impossible. "I didn't realize it," I say.
"You often cried in your sleep," Ruth says to me. "When we were first married, I would hear you at night, and the sound would break my heart. I would rub your back and hush you, and sometimes you would roll over and become silent. But other times it would continue through the night, and in the mornings you would tell me that you could not remember the reason."
"Sometimes I didn't."
She stares at me. "But sometimes you did," she finishes.
I squint at her, thinking her form is almost like liquid, as if I'm staring at her through shimmering heat waves that rise from the asphalt in summer. She wears a navy dress and a white hairband, and her voice sounds older. It takes a moment, but I realize she is 23, her age when I return from the war. "I was thinking about Joe Torre," I said.
"Your friend," she nods. "The one who ate 5 hot dogs in San Francisco. The one who bought you your first beer."
I never told her about the cigarettes, for I know she would have disapproved. Ruth always hated their smell. It is a lie of omission.
but I long ago convinced myself that it was the right thing to do. Yes, I say.